You're listening to Juno Afternoon. Thanks, everyone, for being here with us today. I'm Rhonda McBride. Our first guest has worn a lot of hats, and many of them political. He was a Fish and Game Commissioner under Governor Frank Murkowski, and before that, a Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Walter Hickel. He served as a longtime legislative aide, and today he's a consultant based in the Washington, D.C. area. Also roll in a stint as a police officer, a sheriff's deputy, a hot tar roofer, and a scuba dive instructor, and last but not least, a novelist. And that is what we're here to talk about today with Mekhi Campbell. His new book, North Coast, a thriller and romance that is set in Juneau. It's the second in the series. The first novel was Clean Slate, which also takes place in Juneau. So, Mekhi, you are back to promote your new book. What's it like to be back in town?
I miss Juneau tremendously. There was good reason to make the move, but Juneau is just a very special, wonderful place. We were there at a great time in our lives. We lived in Juneau for 30 years.
So you've had time to know Juneau well. What's the basic story of North Coast?
Well, the basic plot is there's a young woman named Grace Admonson from Juneau who is out kayaking up by the Dawes Glacier. And as they're kayaking back out into Cut Arm, her kayaking companion is accidentally run over by a large yacht. The large yacht has been chartered by a fellow named Josh Foley, who's a sort of Hollywood bad boy and drummer. And the idea was to keep Josh out of trouble prior to a big custody and settlement trial. And all of a sudden now, if Grace lives, there's a big problem and he stands to lose millions and millions of dollars. Grace flees from them through Forge Terror. I don't know if you've ever been through Forge Terror at mid-tide, and it turns into a whitewater rapids and clearly a place that they can't follow her. And in there, she runs into a fellow on a sailboat, and it kind of goes from there.
A lot of times when you're in Juneau, you'll be surprised by seeing one of these gleaming white floating palaces come by. And you wonder, like, who is rich enough to own that? Who's on that boat and what are they doing in Juneau? Is that what sparked this idea for a novel?
A little bit. I think we're all intrigued. We always lived where you could look down and see the boats in the harbor and you wonder what's up. There's a wonderful novel, The Shipping News, where they write a newspaper column about who's in town, what boats are in town in the harbor. And I always thought that'd be a great thing for Juneau.
So is Grace the main character?
Grace is, I think, the central character who ties it together. And she runs into Mick Halloran, who is a ex-sailboat racer, who's up sort of in Alaska sailing by himself, kind of trying to get away from some past events in his life. And the two of them together and their relationship is a central part of the story.
Grace sounds like an interesting character. I mean, someone who disappears behind the rapids. Can you tell us a little more about her?
You bet. This is something that I spent a lot of time thinking about and talking to people and wanting to do it correctly and appropriately. Grace is a second grade teacher who works at Reader's Bookstore in the fall, but Grace has a father from Petersburg who's of Norwegian descent. Her maternal grandmother was Tlingit and her maternal grandfather was Filipino. There's some talk in the book about the native heritage in Southeast Alaska and the Filipino heritage there. And so I tried to work hard to get that right and do it in a good way. Some people were very helpful to me on that. In particular, Andrew Hope was very helpful to me on native naming protocols and what was appropriate in terms of talking about Tlingit name, Moiety clan and tribe. Byron Mlott was helpful to me in that. Some other friends up there were very helpful to me in that.
Did your last book, Clean Slate, did it incorporate native culture like this one?
Clean Slate did not really incorporate native culture. And that's such an important part of Alaska and Southeast. I'm going to be very curious as others read it, how they feel about it.
What did having a character with Native heritage add to your book, you think?
I think it's a critical part of Alaska and Southeast Alaska. I thought it brought depth and interest to it. There's also an Alaska State Trooper on the dive team, Leon, who's the Tlingit, and I think a very appealing and intriguing character. I think it just adds extra and presents the population of Southeast more in the mix, more the way it is.
So do you ever have any hopes that maybe some of your novels might be turned into a movie?
I'm laughing because Barbara Campbell, my wife, who many up there will know, has from the very first gone, screenplay, screenplay. And I did have some reviewers refer to the cinematic quality. What I've said is, I don't know how to write a screenplay. If somebody wants to take it and make a movie, that'd be wonderful. But it's not, I think, within my skill set.
Your new book, North Coast, does have some of the same characters that were in your first book, Clean Slate, namely Pete and Annie McLaughlin, who live way, 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 way out in the outskirts of Juneau, and they have quintessentially Alaskan adventures / misadventures. How's that book doing?
It's actually done well. I've been very pleasantly surprised. It came out in March of 2020, which is exactly when COVID hit. But it has slowly and steadily been increasing in sales over time. And we are fortunate to receive some good editorial reviews. One of the things that a number of reviewers have said about both books is that Alaska and the wilderness, et cetera, is sort of a real character in the books and drives a lot of elements of the plot in both cases.
For you, what is it that goes into making a good book?
Well, two things. For me, what I usually care about in a book is I have to care about the characters. There's some books you'll read where you think, I don't like these people. and I don't care too much if something bad happens to them or whatever. I think you have to have characters people care about. Had a reviewer said, Pete and Annie will live with you for a long, long time. And then something else that matters to me a lot is accuracy. When I'm reading a book, I may be going along and enjoying it a great deal and stuff. And all of a sudden you hit a factual issue, any host of things, how a particular boat is set up or a firearm or whatever. It's just wrong. And something goes clunk. It's a false note that destroys your disbelief.
Well, one of the things that is intriguing is your resume. I mean, it is truly a mixed bag from having been a scuba diving teacher to being a police officer. And of course, all your experience in politics. Does that help in coming up with the details for a novel? Do you use that background?
Yeah, I think it does. I was in law enforcement for 7 years, 3.5 as a police officer, 3.5 as an investigator for a sheriff's department right out of college in Ohio. And I did that up until I moved to Alaska. And that provided valuable experience, knowledge about how certain things work. And that was good. And then getting out and around more than anything else helped. So if you're talking about Forged Terror at mid-tide, it would be hard to do, I think, without having been there. So, yeah, I do think it helped.
Where do you get your ideas for your stories? I mean, obviously, certain things that happen might suggest a storyline, but like in the case of Pete and Annie McLaughlin, and Pete, of course, has a secret and it comes back and unfolds in the novel, but where did that come from?
I'm not sure. You start along and you have various ideas, and I admire and am somewhat envious of people who can plot out their entire book beforehand. You know, this is what's going to happen in chapter 10, et cetera. I'm more about get some good characters, put them in the situation, and then see what they're going to do and what's plausible and not plausible as we proceed. It often turns out the characters want to go somewhere different. and I give them their head.
Probably people will wonder if your characters in your two novels are based on real people, or maybe are they composites of people that you know?
Well, they're all fictional characters. However, a number of their names are borrowed. For instance, Pete McLaughlin, the main protagonist in Clean Slate, I borrowed his first name from my friend Pete Rouse, who in the early 80s lived just down the block from us and was Terry Miller's chief of staff. And then I borrowed his last name, my friend Harry Noah, who's commissioner of natural resources under Hickel. His wife is named Claire McLaughlin, and I wanted a sort of different Scottish name, and so I borrowed her last name for that.
And I guess Pete went on to work for President Obama, right?
He did. Pete had worked in the Alaska Senate for Tom Daschle when he was chief of staff there. He then became Obama's chief of staff right at the very end of his Senate career. And Pete was the second guy that President Obama hired.
You mentioned that you were working on Clean Slate in the 80s. What were you doing in the 80s?
In the 80s, I was working in the Alaska legislature. I was working then for Arliss Sterjaluski and wrote about three chapters, put it in the drawer, never did anything more with it. Then when I left Fish and Game in 2007, I retired as commissioner. I said, you know what I want to do is I want to get that back out and see what I can do. And so I wrote that, and really from January till about July, wrote the rest of the book.
So the big question for people might be, why aren't you writing about politics and things that you've been directly involved with? Because maybe you should write a book. You've experienced a vast panorama of Alaska characters in politics.
There are, but you know, I've been privileged to do sort of politics for my living all my life, but it's not something I want to spend all the rest of my time with. You know, it's good to have some clear alternative. There are almost no politics in either book.
Almost no politics.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to continue our conversation and just pick your brain on politics. But before we go, for people that would like to see you this evening, where do they go?
Hearthside Books at Merchant Wharf from 4:30 to 7. We'll be there signing books.
I'm sure you're going to have a lot of people there to see you. Well, there's so much I'd like to ask you. So when we come back, let's talk politics. Given all the hats that you've worn over the years, I can't resist getting your take on things. So I hope that's okay with you.
Happy to do so.
Okay. Well, we'll continue our conversation with Mackay Campbell when we come back. Listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride, and we're back with Mackay Campbell, author of North Coast and Clean Slate. But he also has, aside from being a novelist, an extensive political career in Alaska, working for two governors, working for the legislature, as well as working for Senator Lisa Murkowski, and now an energy and natural resources company in Washington, D.C. How does all of this mesh? How does this work for you?
Well, you know, my career has certainly evolved. I've been very blessed and fortunate to have a whole series of good bosses. Things move from one to the other.
So I have to ask you, since you're based in Washington, D.C., and of course you did work in Lisa Murkowski's office as her staff director on her Senate Energy Committee. So all of the things that are going on in Washington, D.C. must be very vivid to you. What's your take on January 6th?
I thought it was a sad, sad moment for our nation. Let me unequivocally say these were not people behaving like tourists. I think we'll move through it. I think in some ways, as dangerous and scary as it all was, that it showed the strength of our democracy, that we can take that kind of blow and keep on going and stuff. And so that's good.
Well, I'm sure that your thoughts must go to Lisa Murkowski, your former boss. What's your take on how she's navigating these days? Because although she is in the Senate minority, she seems to be a person in the spotlight and maybe has a lot of power at this point in history.
Well, you know, in Congress right now, perhaps more than for a long time, there is intense partisanship. When I first came back to Washington, one of the things that just bothered me the most was what I view as the hypocrisy of people who are for something if it helps their party or situation one day, and then a week later can be exactly against something if they don't think it helps them, and a malleability of values. Senator Murkowski, in my view, has shown the courage and leadership to say, I'm going to do what's best for Alaska. And she's clearly a Republican, but she says, first of all, she's a citizen of Alaska and the United States, and it's going to do what's best for Alaska. And that's not always easy. It's much easier just to kind of go along with the crowd.
Well, you worked for her father not too long after he appointed her to become senator to replace him in the Senate. Looking back at that perspective, seeing the person you saw then and the person you see now.
You know, I was very unsure when he did that about the wisdom of that appointment. I think that has turned out to be the best and defining action of his political career is to give us Lisa. I think actually from her father being a senator, she has inherited a strong set of values about the Senate as an institution and about our democracy. And that is sadly increasingly rare among members of the Senate and even more so among members of the House, where she cares about the institution and how it works for the country.
Well, she looks to be facing an uphill battle for re-election. Of course, it's probably predictable because she is not in step with the majority of her colleagues.
Well, I'm not sure it's going to be an uphill battle. I do think it will be a battle. You know, there's a saying in Washington, there are two ways to run. One is unopposed and the other is paranoid. So you want to take it very, very seriously. But I have faith in Alaskans to look at the available candidates and any honest look at her career and what she's done for Alaska, I think it gives a very clear indication of where you should go. I'm highly prejudiced and partisan about this. I freely admit that.
Okay. I guess we can forgive you for that since you did work for her. But you also headed up her staff on the Senate Energy Committee when she was chair. And now are an energy consultant. So I'd like to get your take on what we're hearing with climate change escalating. Fossil fuels are now obsolete. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. There was, I thought, an excellent column by a friend of mine named Amy Harder. Amy is just one of the top-notch energy reporters in the nation. And she makes the very persuasive case that if we stop producing oil at a faster rate, then the demand of oil goes down. We actually imperil the move towards cleaner energy and a cleaner environment.
So I'm curious, what are your thoughts about our future with natural gas?
You know, I think it was in the early 80s, I was down in Seattle, natural gas conference, and there was a fellow named Arlen Tussing, who at the time was the preeminent natural gas economist. And he said, I have great news for Alaska. You have just tremendous amounts of natural gas. He said, I also have bad news for Alaska. So does everybody else, and theirs is nearer tidewater. And, you know, I think he has unfortunately been proven right throughout the ensuing decades. We do have a tremendous amount of gas, and it also may be down the road that LNG container ships could simply access the North Slope, take out gas directly without a pipeline. I don't know. I'd love to see the pipeline, but the economics of it remain intensely challenging.
It's quite the saga, isn't it? And to think that you've followed it all of these years. Are you sure that you might not want to take a stab at this and turn it into a political novel?
I think about it once in a while, but I have to admit, Barb says I'm happy when I write. I'm not sure that would be the case if I was writing about politics.
Okay. No politics. But what are you working on now?
Right now, I'm working on a third book called Pitfall, and that one's actually set out in Bristol Bay. You know, have some ideas, and I'm starting to develop some characters.
So we're going to hear about fishing in this next book.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. So I presume that Pebble Mine is going to feature prominently in your next book. Are you going to be pro-Pebble, anti-Pebble?
Well, there is a fictional mine called named Rock Mountain that has shares a lot of characteristics with the Pebble Mine. You know, just personally, I was first out at Pebble in 1992 as Deputy Commissioner of Fish and Game. And from the first time I was out there, I thought, well, I think this is going to be tremendously difficult for anybody to come up with a way to do, but they deserve a chance to put together a mine plan and perhaps propose it and have it evaluated. In 2018, I actually saw the final mine plan. In my judgment, as someone who's working on a lot of mines, it was a shoddy and dangerous plan. In Pitfall, the name of the work in progress set in Bristol Bay, I've tried to take some of the knowledge of what I've learned over these last number of years working against Pebble and put it into the book. The challenge is I don't want it to be just an environmental screed. I want it to be real in terms of how it affects people's lives.
Wow. Well, we will look forward to that. I'm sure a lot of Alaskans will find that book fascinating.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, I want to thank you, Mackay Campbell, author of North Coast and Clean Slate, for joining us. And we hope that we can have you back at some point to talk about your next novel.
Rhonda, thank you. It's been great. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for joining us. One more note on Mackay Campbell. He has a meet and greet at Merchant's Wharf tonight at the Hearthside Bookstore from 4:30 to 7, where he'll be signing some of his books. And while you're out and about, check out some of the other First Friday events. Mary McEwen will be on hand at the Juno Artist Gallery tonight, where she is the featured artist this month. And we'll also hear about Mary's adventurous approach to art when we come back.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Great to have you here with us today on Juno Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. Another event to take in, a First Friday exhibit at the Juno Artist Gallery, which showcases the work of Mary McEwen, a painter who produces art in a variety of styles. Are you excited to be this month's featured artist?
Yeah, I am. Thanks for having me, Rhonda.
So what out of your work have you decided to spotlight this month? I imagine that you've got a lot to choose from.
I do. But in the past year and a half, I've been sewing masks, and that's really actually what's kept me going. Is sewing about 600 cloth masks. So that's one of the things that I sell at the gallery. But our shared space, because we're a co-op, each person has their own wall space that we share the rent of in our space in the Senate building. We have one wall that's right in front of the front door that rather than being assigned to one person, it's such prime real estate that that space rotates from month to month. And then we have a featured artist. So when it's my turn to get that space, rather than just move what I already have from one side of the gallery to the other side in front of the door, I like to think about something new and something different that I could fill up that space with. So for this month, I came up with a concept that's a little weird. I've been reflecting a lot about solid waste. Bear with me.
Okay. Solid waste as inspiration for art.
And I mean that like in terms of not only just stuff and consumer goods that we bring into the world and buy and consume and that go to the landfill and things that we buy and hang on to and are even left behind when we die. And what do we do with that stuff? And how do we like turn the volume down on making and consuming stuff? And so that's kind of the background for the collection of items that you'll see when you walk in, because primarily I'm a painter. And so there is a little collection of small paintings. And the way that portion of it came about was I went down to my parents' house last month and we were going through old boxes of things that were left behind by my grandparents and deciding what to toss, what to do with any of this stuff. And there were all of these dozens and dozens of little gold frames that had held the school pictures and the wedding pictures in this like same little fussy gold frilly style. And I thought, rather than toss these, I'm going to make art to go in these frames and just have it be a collection altogether. Usually when we make art, the framing and the presentation is kind of the last step in the process when we're thinking about what something's going to look like. We make the piece and then decide what kind of framing is appropriate. I put the cart before the horse and said, okay, I'm going to make paintings to go in these frames. And because they were very fussy and delicate, I made a bunch of small watercolor paintings of different kind of flower blossoms. And so there's my ode to grandma's frames. So that's the painting piece of it.
Ode to grandma's frames. I bet you those frames are lovely because frames today are more or less mass produced.
Yeah, they have kind of a fun vintage feel to them, certainly.
You can find in some of your artwork anything from serene landscapes to your flower paintings. But I've also wondered about your hand-painted rocks. I saw a photo on your Instagram and they're just lovely, just beautiful designs, kind of little tiny point spatter designs. And I just have to ask you, are you one of the mystery rock painters? One of those people that leaves rocks along our trails and boardwalks for people to discover? Is that you? Or are you part of a group?
I am not part of that group, but I know that my rocks have been purchased by others who have hid them. I haven't participated in that rock hiding myself, but it is a really fun project. It's kind of relaxing to just paint all those dots. At Juno Fine Arts Camp, taught a couple classes of kindergarten through, I think, fifth grade. And I know those kids were excited to take their skills and make some rocks to hide along trails. So, yeah.
Well, I guess that's oh so Juno.
Definitely.
Well, it seems that in addition to colorful art, you've got a colorful life. And one of the things I read in your bio that was intriguing was that you live downtown in a 1890s mining shack. The use of the word shack, it evoked all kinds of images. A miner's shack?
Well, you know, like a lot of houses in the Juneau Townsite neighborhood, which is just up the hill from downtown, that's what the houses that are still standing were originally constructed as miners housing, our house and the ones around the corner from it. It's a funky place with a lot of character, which is what drew us to it.
So you've been in the Peace Corps, and I was curious, what did you do in the Peace Corps? Where did you go?
I was in West Africa in the country of Togo about 20 years ago to do my Peace Corps service. I was working in the field of health education, but I also did a lot of work with the local school in the village where I was at.
So you also have a master's in public health from Yale, but at this point in your life, you're focusing on your art. You'd think that with a master's in public health that you'd be on the front lines of fighting COVID.
Yeah, life is funny sometimes like that. It's true. But yeah, I mean, the timing is pretty hilarious because like to quit a job in the field of public health right before a worldwide pandemic. So yeah, I do have a graduate degree in international health policy, but I'm making art out of garbage. So come see that.
It doesn't really sound like garbage. It sounds like...
No.
It sounds more like recycling, which is something that's good to hear about as well. You do so many different kinds of art. I just have to wonder, is there a common thread in all of this?
I think the common thread is really just about the exploration and the process of it. I'm one of those people that, you know, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. And for me, art is a great way to explore so many different things. And I think integrating all of those different varied pieces of my life, including my kids and how they influence my art making. So you'll see that I have a really varied style, I guess, is what I can say. And so the common thread is just that it's my way of exploring what's around me and what I've experienced.
So if people want to come out and visit with you tonight at First Friday, what time can they do that?
I will be at the gallery between 4:30 and 6. The gallery is open 7 days a week from 9 to 6 and sometimes a little later. We're on the first floor of the Senate building down on Franklin Street.
And your exhibit will be up all month. So if you don't make it tonight, you can see it all later on. Thanks a lot for joining us. Mary McEwen, who is this month's featured artist at the Juno Artists Gallery. Thanks, Mary, for telling us about your work and sort of your interesting journey creating your art.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Rhonda.
Up next, a chance to win a diamond, lots of cash, and best of all, to help pay for scholarships. 75 years of the Golden North Salmon Derby when we come back. thank you for being here with us today for Juno Afternoon. Great to have everyone here with us. I'm Rhonda McBride. Today, we're celebrating the 75th anniversary of the Golden North Salmon Derby, and there is lots to celebrate. And here to give us an appreciation for this long-standing Juno tradition, Ron Somerville and Sean Hooten, members of the Territorial Sportsman, the group that sponsors the Derby. Ron, perhaps we should start off with you to give us a little history of how this Derby came to be.
Well, I think back in the towards the end of the mining era here in Juneau, they decided they needed some diversion. So the Territorial Sportsman, which was in existence then, 1946, I believe it was, they started the first Derby. At times they offered some unique prizes, an automobile one year, and I don't remember all the other prizes, but looking at the history of the Derby, it was unique. Unique for Juneau, relatively smaller in those days. It was interesting that the businesses virtually shut down, employees could participate in the Derby. So it was a big community event. We've diminished from that type of exposure today, but we still enjoy somewhere between 1,200 and 1,600 people fishing in the Derby. The first recipient of the scholarship was Philip by the name of Harris, who was related to one of the original founders of Juneau.
Huh, that's an interesting bit of historical trivia. So, Sean, this year's Derby starts a week from today on an auspicious or inauspicious, I'm not sure, Friday the 13th, and it runs through August 15th. But, you know, maybe the 13th will be a lucky day for some fishermen.
We can definitely hope so. We're hoping for good weather. Hopefully the cohos will arrive. Usually they show up mid-month, give or take. And so that's why we kind of target our Derby around that. We're also looking to get some kings as well.
So Sean, maybe you could give us an explanation of how this Derby works. How do you enter? What are the competitions?
We've got a whole lot of things going on this year, but the basis is we've got some top weighed fish prizes. You know, of course, for the largest, usually it's a king salmon that starts up there in the $10,000 range for cash. We've got some other ones based on whether or not you turn in weighed fish. For every ticket that you buy for the Derby, they enter you into what we call a high five prize. It's called the Ticket Holder High Five, and it's sponsored by Boinkles this year. We call them a high five, where you get 40 sealed envelopes put up on a board, and you pick basically when you get five of each envelope of the same number. And some of those prizes, like this one in particular, would be $48,000 if you get the top one. And of course, this 48 is coming for 48 years of Boinkles being in business. And of course, the next level down is $4,800, $480. And then we also have a $48 plus a $480 Boinkles gift certificate. We also have several other big ones, including a large sponsored high five for Hecla Greens Creek and Core Kensington combined. And that can be as high as $50,000 on that high five. And those are for the scholarship fish tickets. And that is for people that don't want to weigh their fish in, but they want to turn them in for door prizes that are through the scholarship. Most of the money that we get from the Derby goes right back into the scholarship to take care of our graduating seniors that are on their way into either a tech program or a four-year college.
So, Ron, I have to ask you, in all the years of the Derby, how much has the Territorial Sportsman spent on scholarships?
The total is right around $1.9 million. Today, the scholarship, individual scholarship, four-year scholarship, if you will, amounts to about $13,000 spread out over the 4 years. So I might also add that, I can't remember the year, but the Territorial Sportsman created a separate organization of which they're affiliated with, the Territorial Sportsman Scholarship Foundation. What it does is manage giving out the scholarships, interviewing the candidates. They're responsible for administering that program. They also invest any money that is either returned because a student doesn't complete the 4 years, or we get donations or whatever to the scholarship fund. And that fund today is right up around $700,000 which is almost big enough to continue the scholarship program regardless of what the Derby ends up doing. But we'd like to see it continue at a little bit higher level, maybe granting more scholarships.
So it's almost kind of a Derby permanent fund.
That's a good correlation.
So there's a lot of money involved, prizes that are almost like a year's salary for somebody. How do you raise this kind of money aside from just the people that enter and pay their fees? I mean, that can't be how you raise this money entirely.
Well, the Derby has been almost exclusively responsible for the money, like sale of the fish. We get permit from Fish and Game to sell the fish or turn it into the Derby. Then that money goes into the fund. It's been almost exclusively the Golden North Salmon Derby that is responsible for this program.
In other words, the sale of the fish that the fishermen catch is kind of what has created this pool.
That's correct. Plus, we do get some donations. This year, we're getting $2,500 from Toyota.
So that's very impressive that you are able to do this. In honor of the 75th birthday of the Derby, are you doing some things differently this year just because it's the anniversary?
Yeah, we are actually rolling out a new team competition this year, and we decided the 75th would be a good time to try it. We've talked about it on and off for a year or two just to see if we could do it. And this year we decided to do it based on the fish count totals for each team. The way it's set up is that all of the folks that buy team tickets, and that's typically a team of four on a boat and fishing from the same vessel, and they all buy their team Derby tickets. And that's $100 a piece instead of the normal regular ticket price. The way the team competition will work is that all of the fish that the team folks catch, they get to use for also the weighed-in fish and the scholarship prize. So we're basically just taking the totals of the boats that turn in their fish each day, and then we have a top three prizes set up for that. And it's also in a high-five system. First place, the maximum prize capable is $75,000. The second prize will be $25,000, and the third place is $10,000. And of course, those are high-fives, so they're like all random choice. And the smallest amount is a $500 prize plus mystery prize. And the mystery prize is based on how much fish I believe we sell and part of the ticket prices. We kind of have a little combined, basically, kind of an idea of what it may be as far as the minimum prize. We kind of take based on fish sales and, you know, the price of fish and that kind of thing. We also have a diamond ring being given away, as the diamond is the 75th anniversary. So that'll be in our winning raffle. Those will be picked right after the Derby on Sunday night. We'll do a random drawing for that.
A diamond ring. Boy, you guys have thrown out a lot of numbers here in talking about all the prizes and scholarships. This year, how much are you spending in total? Any idea, a ballpark?
$150,000, probably.
That is a lot of money. What do you think makes the Derby so popular? Is it the money or is it the event itself?
In the early days, it was just a diversion for the whole community turned out for the Derby because we were much smaller and it became a real exciting annual event. Now I think the thing that probably prompts people to participate more than anything else is the contribution to the scholarship program. At least my soliciting from the businesses and private individuals, that's one of the things they ask almost annually is, well, how is the scholarship program doing? I do think some people are obviously fishing in it for the purpose of trying to hit the top weight or one of these programs. I might mention that one year we had a tagged fish program. A local person did win the $100,000 tagged fish prize. So we've had some big payouts from some of the Derby prizes we've offered.
Also, with Ron's mention, I personally know the award winner of that $100,000 fish, and she very frequently redonates money back into our scholarship and into our Derby every year.
There's a lot of things that go into this derby, from the fun of fishing to the sense that you're helping kids get scholarships. Tell me about some of your favorite derby memories, and we'll start with you, Ron.
I guess the thing I remember most about the derby was the old Nemans start. It used to be there would be a cannon go off and every boat in Auk Bay would take off at the same time. And the Coast Guard warned us that this is becoming a little hazardous to the small vessels. So we changed that to Pacific time so the vessels could depart from Auk Bay on Friday at a reasonable rate. And that's worked pretty well.
So before we go, do you want to give us a way that we can find out more if we want to take part in this?
Yeah, you bet. GoldenNorthSalmonDerby.com is our website, and it has quite a bit of information. We have four ticket vendors, DeHart's Auk Bay Store, Foodland IGA Hardware, Sportsman's Warehouse, and Western Auto Marine.
All right. Ron Somerville and Sean Hooten, members of the Territorial Sportsmen, thank you for being here with us and telling us about this marvelous program that is doing so much for the community. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Up next, we go from fish to birds, our summer bird watching series from the Juneau Audubon Society, when we come back. Send you off to the weekend with one more conversation on Juneau Afternoon. I'm Rhonda McBride. As we have been doing every Friday this summer, a little armchair bird watching with Brenda Wright from the Juneau Audubon Society, and she's always on the lookout for the best bird watching opportunities. I know, Brenda, last week you suggested following the salmon. Is that the same story this week?
Yes, I really highly recommend it. If you would like to see the gulls or the eagles up close and interacting, get good photos, go on down to the hatchery at Salmon Creek and enjoy the show.
Are they still out there in numbers like last week?
Oh my gosh, yes. When I was driving by the other day at a low tide, I easily counted 50 without turning my eyebrows.
50 so eagles?
Eagles and then hundreds of gulls.
We have three birds of the week, as always. So what have you chosen for our birds of the week this week?
Well, they all live with us all year round, but two of them were introduced to North America on purpose. The rock dove in the early 1600s with the first pioneer folks from England, and the European starling in 1890 in New York because it was a bird mentioned in Shakespeare.
So the rock dove, are they kind of akin to homing pigeons, the kind that people use to send messages back and forth?
Yes, that's correct. They are ours that we have here in Juneau are originally from Europe, and most of them of that style are from Europe or Northern Africa. We do have native pigeons in North America, but they don't like cities as well as these European ones.
So tell us a little bit about the European starling.
Well, the bird is mentioned in Shakespeare, and there was a group in New York City that wanted to have every bird mentioned in Shakespeare brought to Central Park. And in 1890, they released about 50 or 60 starlings, and now they cover North America.
So let's give a listen to the rock pigeon. This bird almost sounds like a chicken roosting. Now we have the European starling, and how do you describe that sound? Kind of harsh to me.
Yes, and it's interesting because they're very vocal. You'll might hear them much sooner than you will see them, but they do have a beautiful marking colors, various iridescent purples and black.
So our last bird of the week, the fox sparrow, is very musical. So it's nice to hear a musical bird. Here we go. This weekend, what are you watching for and where will you go?
Well, the first of the fall migrants are passing back south and they're stopping here as a great place to get a meal. The airport dike trail and the shoreline is a great place to watch for them.
Brenda Wright with the Juneau Audubon Society, capping off our week with a little armchair bird watching. Thanks, Brenda.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Support for Juneau Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klingit and Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
And that'll do it for Juneau Afternoon, which is produced by the KTOO Arts and Culture team. I'm Rhonda McBride. Have a great weekend.